I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to Outcasts with Wicked Witch of the West, Tim Downey, and leader of the Lollipop Guild, David Berry. Today on Outcast, we follow the yellow brick Wilmington Road all the way to Outlander Emerald City, where we will have all our wishes granted. Our guest today has cast all your favourite shows, from Good Omens, Pennyworth, Into the Badlands, Black Sails, Nightfall, the list goes on, and of course, Outlander. She is the very wonderful Suzanne Smith. Suzanne, welcome.
Hi, guys. From London and Australia.
How have you been? How's it all been treating you?
Well, I mean, it's, as we all know, it's very strange because, you know, all production all over the world has ceased. So it's so instead of sort of working 12, 14 hour days, it's very strange to be not working.
How are you occupying your time at the moment?
Well, just before we were in lockdown, I bought a flat, but I haven't been able to move into it. So slowly I'm getting it ready, and I think I'll be in there for about in 3 weeks' time, because I've had to get it painted, and also my furniture is all in lockdown also, so I'm just waiting for everything to be open so I can finally move in.
To hark back to the good old days of casting, we will do our usual of grabbing a scene and playing it out between us, and seeing what comes out, seeing what new frisson we can get from the material. So the scene we have today, which is very exciting, is a Jack Randall scene, and this scene was actually one of the scenes used in the casting of the character of
Yes, it was.
And why was this scene in particular? Why was this scene chosen, do you think?
Well, because it sort of shows the intimidation of Jack Randall towards Claire, so that's why it was chosen. Because, well, we also then, you know, showed the nice, because obviously Tobias plays two roles, so mm-hmm. You've got to see the nice part of him as well as the not so nice.
Yes, so Suzanne, you're going to give us your Claire, wonderful, very exciting, and who is going to give us your the Jack Randall?
It was David, actually.
Oh,
I know, because I thought he can, because he's played such a nice Lord John is so nice, so I'm going to make him play against type.
Excellent. Oh, now this I am looking forward to. Oh, this is going to be
really
tremendous.
Against type. Maybe my lord.
dig deep, David. I think you're gonna find it there somewhere.
Oh, I won't have to dig very deep at all. Don't worry.
Right. Okay. So I shall read stage directions. Very exciting. So here we go. So the Outlander. This is the Jack Randall audition scene. So interior Brockton Inn, Commander's Room, mid morning. A tentative Claire enters the room, only to find herself face to face with Captain Jonathan Jack Randall. The captain stands by the open window, his slim, straight figure silhouetted by the light. Randall turns to Claire, letting out a short laugh.
Ha ha! I wouldn't do it like that. I just... anyway.
You just got nervous, didn't you? Just nervous.
I did it. Okay. Yes, I thought so. It had to be you, from Mackenzie's description. Please make yourself comfortable.
As Claire sits, Randall signals to a young corporal. Hey, this fella. Corporal Hawkins, who stands at attention near the door. Hawkins clumsily pours a mug of ale for Claire. Randall pours himself a mug as well and sinks gracefully onto a stool across the table from Claire.
I'm wondering in the actual audition, when I do that, I'd try and sink gracefully onto a stool. How much would I pay attention to this? I think I could do it. Would I get a stool in the audition? Would there be a stool in the audition? Maybe I just stand. These are the things that would be going through my head in the audition. Anyway, all right. Why don't you tell me who you are and how you came to find yourself here?
I am a widowed lady of Oxfordshire. I was travelling with a manservant en route to distant relatives in France when we were set upon by highwaymen. My servant was either killed or run off, and while wandering in the woods, I was, that is, when you found me.
Oxfordshire, you say? There are no Beauchamps in Oxfordshire that I know of.
How would you know? You're from Sussex yourself.
Claire immediately catches herself, but it's too late, as Randall's eyes pop open in surprise.
May I ask how you know that?
Your voice. Yes, it's your accent, clearly Sussex.
It's not a Sussex accent. I mean, we all know this. It's my RP accent, and I'm not going to any level of nuance here, so I'm just going to power through here. Neither my tutors nor my parents would be much obliged to hear that my speech so clearly reflects my birthplace, madam, because it doesn't. They having gone to considerable trouble and an expense to remedy it by making me sound like an Australian. Sorry, that was my own ad lib. But being the expert at local speech patterns that you are, no doubt you can also identify my corporal's place of origin. Corporal Hawkins, would you oblige me by reciting something, anything at will? Will you, perhaps some popular verse?
Hawkins glances wildly about the room for inspiration before choosing what he hopes will be the right popular verse. Right, here we go. Buxom Meg. I know what you're thinking. It's a lot quite as cultured as Cheshire, but you know, he's just moved there.
Okay.
She washed my clothes and took them all away. I waited thus in sore distress, and then I made her pay. Less than please, Randall, stopped the corporal with a dismissive motion.
That will do, Corporal, thank you. Well?
Cheshire?
Close, Lancashire.
Randall strolls over to the window. Suddenly, he whirls back to face Claire.
Parlez-vous français?
Très bien. What of it?
Randall studies Claire for a measured beat.
Dame, if I think you're French. Could be, I suppose, but I've yet to meet a Frenchie who could tell a Cockney from a Cornishman. What was your maiden name, Miss Beauchamp?
Look, Captain, entertaining as it is to play 20 questions with you, I should really like to conclude these preliminaries and arrange for the continuation of my journey. I've already been delayed for some time, and...
You do not help your case by adopting this frivolous attitude, madam.
I have no case to help. All I want is to be allowed to resume my journey in peace. I see no reason why you ought to have any objection to that.
Oh, don't you? Well, consider my position for a moment, madam, and perhaps my objections will become clearer. A month ago, I was with my men in hot pursuit of a band of unidentified Scottish bandits who had absconded with a small herd of cattle from an estate near the border when...
So that's what they were doing. I wondered.
Randall stops, not accustomed to being interrupted. After a deep breath, he continues his story.
In the midst of this lawless pursuit, I encountered a half-dressed Englishwoman in a place where no Englishwoman should be, even with a proper escort, who resists my inquiries, assaults my person.
You insulted mine first.
Whose accomplice renders me unconscious by a cowardly attack, and who then flees the area, plainly with some assistance. My men and I searched that area most thoroughly, and I assure you, madam, there was no trace of your murdered servant, your plundered baggage, your discarded gown, nor the merest sign that there is the slightest truth to your story.
Oh.
Yes. I'm really getting into this. I love this character.
Yeah, I can tell.
This is really fun.
There's a focus, David, that I haven't seen before.
I know.
I'll be honest with you.
You're absolutely right, Tim.
It's steely.
Yeah, two adversaries. Can't even speak. Great fun.
Anyway, let me get back into it. Sorry. Broke out of character. Get back in.
I'll go.
Broke out of character just to admire it. God, this is good. Sorry. Miles away.
Just wanted everyone to take notice of that. You're right, Tim.
This is sight reading, guys, really, isn't it? So we've got
sight reading. Thank you, Suzanne. Even more reason to laud my efforts here. Furthermore, there have been no reports of bandits in that area within the last 4 months. And now, madam, you turn up in company with the war chieftain of Clan Mackenzie, who tells me that his brother Colum is convinced you are a spy, presumably working for me.
Well, I'm not, am I? You know that, at least.
Yes, I know that. What I don't know is who the devil you are. But I mean to find out, madam. Have no doubts about that. As to that, I am the commander of this garrison. As such, I am empowered to take certain steps in order to secure the safety of this area against traitors, spies, and any other persons whose behavior I consider suspicious. And those steps, madam, I am fully prepared to take.
And just what might those steps be?
Randall stands, looking down at Claire for a moment before walking around the table and drawing her to her feet.
Corporal Hawkins, I shall require your assistance for a moment. Stand behind the lady, please. Corporal, and take her firmly by both elbows.
As the corporal follows the order, Randall draws back and hits Claire in the pit of her stomach. Claire doubles over. Boom. Claire doubles over onto the floor, struggling to take in air. Randall squats down in front of her, a newfound brightness in his eyes.
Trust you not with child, madam, because if you are, you won't be for long. Look at me. Have you anything to say to me now, madam?
Your wig is crooked.
Whoa!
Boom.
Wow.
Boom. That's, end scene.
What a scene. What a scene.
Great scene, isn't
glorious.
It?
That's a great scene.
If I got that, I'd be like, man, I'm playing Jack Randall. There must have been tons of people running to audition for this part.
Well, remember, he's also playing Frank as well. So Jack and Frank.
Hey, you said I can play nice and mean. I mean, I think clearly I can play mean now.
Yeah.
This is the role I should have had, clearly. Sorry, I'm getting a really bit too carried away with my performance here.
It's already been cast, David. It's cast.
I know, I know.
Yeah, season one.
I know.
How many people were seen for Tobias's part in the end?
I can't remember offhand, but not. I mean, obviously, the biggest search was for Claire, actually.
Oh,
it wasn't for Jamie. It was for Claire.
Yeah. How many sort of roughly were they have seen for Claire?
Hundreds. I mean, it's
really?
I can't remember how many, but it because we looked everywhere. We looked here in the UK, we looked in Canada, we looked in Australia.
Mm-hmm. I had one of my friends audition for it. I helped her with a reading.
Oh, did you?
I think I had to play. Yeah, I think, well, maybe I did. I remember going through one of the audition scenes with her and thinking, what is this nonsense, outlander time travel stuff? What is this you're auditioning for? And then I ended up reading, I was like, oh, this is quite interesting. Yeah. And then lo and behold, several years later, I'd be on the show. Yes, they did book in Australia.
Yeah, so it was a worldwide search for Claire. And because she has so, as you know, there's so many qualities that she has to show. So it's getting that strength of character that she has, as well as the warmth and the humor, the vulnerability. I mean, all the multifacets that Kat.
And when certain people walk into a room, do you instinctively think, I think this person's going to be that part? And obviously, there's probably a few people that hit that mark.
Sometimes that happens. It's not always up to you, to me, to make that. It's not up to me to make that decision. You know, ultimately, it's a lot of people, as you know. It's, you know, producers, network, director. It's so many people have an input.
Maybe we need to know before we get into it for the people at home. What is a casting director? What is the job of a casting director?
Yeah, that's a very, I'm glad you say casting director, because so many people call us casting agents, which we hate, because I'm not an agent. I don't look up, an agent looks after actors and helps you, you both got agents, helps you to get jobs. A casting director works closely with the director, producers, network, and director to show their vision on the piece, talk to them, find actors that are right. Sometimes you need names in order to get a production off the ground. With Outlander, that because it was with stars, they said we don't need names, which is fantastic. You know, we want to make stars of the actors. So it was really refreshing that we could look everywhere and have that opportunity to find the right, you know, right actors for the role. So the process, you know, we check if you need names, obviously we check availabilities of actors. And then, you know, if you are going to make a straight offer to a named actor, then you send a script, make a financial offer. They either want to do it or they don't, because they might not, you know, gel with the role or not. But the other part of it, you know, for every single role on Outlander, nobody really got a script. You didn't get scripts, did you guys?
No.
We send scenes out. So we've just done a scene. So we send scenes. We put out a breakdown for the role. So a breakdown summarizes what the show is about, who's involved in it. That's the producer, director, say network. And then it has a description of all the roles. And also we have, you know, normally dates of when we need the actors, and also sort of what union it is, or is it non-union, or, you know, so you've got all the information for you, the actor, and for the agent. So we send out breakdowns. We equally check availability of actors, because part of a casting director is that we should know actors. Before coming a full casting director, I was a casting assistant. So you learn all the agents, you learn the process, you check availabilities. Then also you bring actors in to audition for the role. You send out the scenes. Sometimes, you know, if you're doing like a Marvel movie, you have to sign a non-disclosure agreement, an NDA. So because it's all secret. And sometimes you don't really get the right scene because they don't want to disclose that you're playing, you're auditioning for a larger role. So actors either sort of come in and audition or they self-tape. And you can imagine, you know, sometimes an actor is available at the beginning of the week, but they might not be available at the end of the week because they might have taken another job. Mm. And if you're really with a good agent, you know, the agent will sort of ring you and just sort of say, oh, by the way, I've got an offer on the table for, you know, a theatre gig or another show, but my client would like to do your show as opposed to the other show, or not, you know, sort of. So, you know, we hope that agents do let us know that information. So we're constantly, you know, if we know that an actor is liked, or if we really like an actor and we keep tabs on them for the production. But now with everything that in the world has changed, I think, you know, there won't be at the moment, there won't be when we get up and running again, there won't be so many face-to-face auditions. It will be mostly self-taping.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you could describe where you think the craft comes in. What is the craft of the casting director?
Well, the craft is, I mean, the other thing that casting directors do is we, you know, go to the theatre. Not that there is any theatre at the moment, but I mean, you spend a lot of time, you know, going to the theatre, getting to know actors, going to drama schools, watching television, watching films. So you get to know, you know, actors as well as, you know, sometimes meeting them in person. So that is part of the craft, is that you see them develop from, say, drama school to their first sort of job. And, you know, I and my office sort of make a... we find, you know, we do help a lot of actors because, you know, if you've been to drama school, you probably only get like a week of camera work because mostly it's for theatre.
That's very true.
So we do help a lot sort of with coming in for the audition to help them, put them at ease, give them tips on how to approach, you know, camera work.
Tim, did you go into Suzanne's office?
I did. Yes, I did. I know it well.
How about the two of you walk us through that? Because I want to hear that. My experience is completely different. I want to hear what happens when you go into Suzanne's office, Tim, from perspective of an actor, and then maybe from the perspective of Suzanne might be interesting.
Well, from the perspective of an actor, it's actually one of my favourite, because Suzanne will usually say, you know, the room is ready. If you want to just go in and prepare yourself, which is, for me, perfect, because there's nothing better than just kind of going into the room, being in the room, but nobody else is there. And just kind of going, okay, this is the scene. This is what we'll be doing. Just running it a few times in your head, just so you get an idea of, okay, this is how it's going to be. This is how we're going to do. Because it is quite nerve, as all actors know. It's very nervy to walk straight into a room and everybody be there. Or especially if it's the first time you're going up for a part. And then Suzanne comes in, and then it begins. So from my point of view, that first initial moment just to kind of calm, focus, and then to get ready for what you're going to do, to hopefully do it exactly right, is vital. How do you find it, Suzanne?
Yes, I mean, we tend to hear, and I am in my office at the moment, is we don't overschedule. So we don't have actors waiting, you know, en masse. We tend to give time to everybody because we want to make them feel sort of comfortable, because we know it's sort of you're having to learn lines. We've got the camera, you know, reading with actors. And we want you to feel as comfortable as possible, because we want you to do the best. And to make you feel comfortable in the situation. So we always have, you know, water here if you want water. And I know I'm very lucky in that I have an office with a studio, because, you know, sometimes casting directors don't have that luxury and they're at Spotlight or another studio. And then, you know, time matters. And so a lot of the actors then sort of, you see them, don't you, waiting, sort of friends.
I appreciate the water. And I reckon maybe a therapist there as well, a life coach. Just the simple creature comforts to make the experience a little nicer.
Like you were saying earlier, it's all about relationships, and it's kind of like very early relationships, be it that you see them at drama school or in a play and they kind of catch your eye.
Yes.
And all of these kind of early relationships that begin and then grow and then they, you know, become what they become. And how do you think where we are now, that will change? Because if things are being sent in, say it's going to be a lot more self-tapes, is it going to be harder to kind of get that relationship with an actor?
I think it is, and I really do feel for the drama school students that didn't get their opportunity to do their showcases this year, because, you know, a lot of the showcases were March, April, May, where, you know, they've missed out on agents as well as casting directors. I know that Spotlight here, which sort of we tend to put sort of our breakdowns out via, have been really great in sort of gathering all, and also the drama schools have been very helpful in making sure that they have filmed the actors of their final year, so we can view them as opposed to meet them in person. But I think with, you know, Zoom has helped an awful lot, and it is quite user friendly.
Hmm. Well, hey, Suzanne, we never met, and I got this wrong. No, I walked in Sydney, Australia,
and I never met Pat. Because she self taped, and so that was great in the sense, but that she got the role from a tape, and which I had on my desk, because when she did it, it's the scene that the Claire scene that I gave you. And I put it there on my desktop and I didn't post it because I kept thinking, because it wasn't quite right, because it was a lot. And then her agent rang me and said, what did you think? And I said, actually, I've got it on my desktop. So my instinct told me that he'd just become her agent here in the UK. And he said, can you send it? He hadn't seen it. Can you send it to me? And I sent it to him. And I said, there's a problem. And he agreed when he looked at it. And so he said, give me all the notes. I gave him all the notes. She retaped. I'd put her picture up on the website. One of my producers said, who's that beautiful, beautiful actress that you haven't got the tape? I'm waiting for the tape to come. Mm-hmm. I said, I'll let you know as soon as I've got it. And this was really towards the end of the casting. As soon as I got it, I sent it out to everybody and they went, we're testing her.
Wow. It goes to show that the things that there's so many steps there that could have gone wrong.
Well, but it was there ready for me to, I was going to give notes. So it was there on my desktop for that.
There seems to be so many things that could have gone wrong there. I mean, and a lot of actors, when they go into an audition or book a role, they construct this narrative that somehow they kind of felt like they were destined for the role. And when we look back, we kind of think like maybe Kat was always destined for the role. Like it's like some of the universe was pushing them in that direction. But maybe it's because like as actors, so much is out of our control and we like to feel that like fate played a hand in our casting. But not to take anything away from what you do, but do you think there is a degree of the kismet in casting, like somehow the universe conspires to help you find the right person for the job?
Sometimes, but sometimes you know, I knew that Sam would be Jamie. I mean, it's just because I've known him from drama school, and how many 6 foot, you know, 3+ actors who can act and have his looks. I mean, it's just, you know, sometimes you do know who's right for a role. And it's sometimes the stars align, you know, in the right way, like Good Omens. It's like the stars aligned in a lot of ways. It was
are you a superstitious person? Do you believe in that kind of thing?
I believe you have to be positive. I'm not a negative person. I always sort of believe that you will find leave no stone unturned, and you will find the right person. It's sort of, I've always had that sort of belief in my process that you do, and it is like a jigsaw puzzle, because it's, you can't have, you get one person who links with somebody else and then they link with the rest of the family. It's a bit like that. It's sort of, there are so many connections.
There's always that actor thing. I mean, I've been in for parts where I have walked out, gone, I have given the worst audition I think any human could give.
Oh, that's when you know you're going to get it. That's when you know this, it's yours.
And that's exactly it. And that's exactly it. And you'll walk away to go, that's it. Gone. Forget it.
Often you have agents ring up saying, oh God, they did a terrible audition. Do you mind if they go home and self-tape? And I'm going, no, they were actually.
John Lithgow said this thing. He was cast originally in Tim Burton's Batman as the Joker. And he said that he came in and he was trying to convince Tim Burton he was the absolute worst person for the role. And that ended up getting him the role, funnily enough. I mean, he eventually turned it down and that went to Jack Nicholson. But I definitely felt the same way. I thought that was the worst audition I've done in my life.
Yeah.
And that always is the way that, you know, for sure, it's something about that you're going to get the role.
But there's no rhyme or reason. For instance, when I did come in for Outlander, I actually thought, I think I've done that as well as I could have done. And I was very pleased. I thought, no, I've done that very well, and that's quite rare because usually you know any walk back you go, oh, I should have done that. Should ah, actually that would have sounded better like this, or that would have sounded better like that. A constant analyzing what you could have done wrong or what you could have done better, because once it's out there, it's out in the world, isn't it?
It's out of your control. And you know, as I said, everybody has different opinions. You know, sort of, you're not just pleasing one person, you're pleasing a whole group of people. I have to audition for I audition for things as well, sort of. And normally I know if they like me or not, or, you know, if...
How do you audition for things?
Well, I mean, I read a script and then I go for a meeting or have a meeting on used to be Skype, but I think it'll be on Zoom now, because I think Zoom is much better than Skype.
Right. So you have to go in there to these producers and you're having to audition to get the job to cast this show.
Yeah, I met Ron and Merrill. I'd read the book. So that's so I went and met them. So and
how did that audition go? What did you have to do? You weren't reading sides, were you? You weren't in the room getting ready?
No, I read a book. I read the book. So I could talk about the characters and... And I was, you know, I admired Ron and all his work as well. So it's
and is it quite exciting? Like you mentioned before about certain shows need a name or would like a name, and then that's the kind of hook to then build everything around. Is it? What's the most exciting part of casting? Is it when someone says, much like they said with Outlander, we don't want names, we just want you to find the characters, find the people that embody these parts the best? Does that free you up as a casting director to go, great?
No, I mean, sometimes a name is best, you know, sort of. It's whoever is right for the role, I think. You know, everything has limitations, whether it's on a budget or availability of actors. Because sometimes, you know, you think the most perfect actor is not available, and it might be that it might only be a couple of weeks, it might be a month, it might be years. Then, you know, sort of sometimes, you know, productions move, sometimes they don't. And it's sort of on a name front, yes, because, you know, sort of various broadcasters will might want somebody to or not, you know. A lot of sort of new drama, teen drama, don't necessarily need names.
But do you worry, like you mentioned about the drama schools not having their graduations or very limiting in their graduations, do you think that will have a real kick-on effect to the pool of actors that will then come later on? Like the pool won't be as big potentially because of everything that's happened. It's going to be trickier for younger, say, working class actors to pursue it because of the kind of state that we are in at the moment, therefore reduce the pool of actors.
Well, I think the pool will be reduced anyway, because, I mean, sadly, as you know, when is theatre going to come back? And that affects, because, you know, our country has so much theatre, whether it's regional or in sort of here in London, and you know, theatres are going to go broke, and that's really sad. And that's, you lose then a lot of, you know, local actors. And yes, you're right about working class, you know, actors. There's recently there have been several sort of drama schools which have sort of opened up to cater for students who have who don't have the money to go to a drama school because it's very costly. But I don't know how this will affect now, because obviously we don't know, you know, sort of part of being a drama student is that you meet and you do auditions face to face. So it doesn't quite work with Zoom or FaceTime, or you need that intimacy. It's going to be quite tricky, I think, in the next, to see how this evolves.
If you can't earn money as an actor, then how are you even going to be even attempt to audition for it?
Exactly. But that, I think that's with a lot of people. It's we're going to find that a lot of jobs are not going to be coming back, a lot of restaurants. And
Well, that's what our actors do. If you're not working as an actor, you're usually a restaurant or an Uber driver or something. And you're usually a part-time actor until you get something. A lot of actors have other jobs throughout their life.
Tim, what was yours? What was your first?
My first job. Well, when I was at drama school, I used to work in a garage, which was horrendous. I was the only person working. So I think because I was quite sort of arty. Hello. People just used to come in and steal petrol. A lot of cars would drive in vans, steal petrol, flip me the bird as they drove away. So I was like, oh God, I'm just trying to phone the police. So that was interesting. But then immediately when I left drama school to earn some cash, I worked in telemarketing.
You'd be great at
it. So I was those wonderful people that ring up. Great gig. Ooh. Great gig.
Yeah. Great to train you for rejection.
Oh, I mean, there were some absolute choice ones, but there's been some other actors who have actually come from that part. Oliver Maltman, for instance, we used to work together doing telemarketing. And the worst one, just to digress here, the worst one I've ever had was for an insurance company. Now, usually when you ring up, people think you are from the insurance company, let's say Prudential or something, but you're not, you're a third party. So I can remember ringing this woman up and she said, yes, it was all very sudden. My husband, he left the room in the middle of the night, and my son, my baby son, had obviously left out like a roller skate on the stairs. The doctors said that he had broke his neck instantly when he hit the floor. Oh, God. And that he was dead on scene. And I had to go, okay, but on a scale of 1 to 10, where would you put Prudential's reaction to that? Well, I just don't know. I need a number.
No.
I don't know, 5 or 6. It has to be one. It has to be 5 or 6. Maybe a 6. Thank you. And then move. It was horrific. And we did it for about a month, ringing up bereaved people who the insurance had not paid out. That was Tim. The worst. And that was the end of it. By the time I got to the end of that, I went, I'm never doing this job again. It was absolute. It ripped you to pieces. But it certainly prepared you for life as an actor.
Yes,
I can tell you.
For rejection, yeah. What was your job, David?
Yeah, I used to work while I was on a network show, I was working in the local supermarket, being a checkout from time to time, and then people would be like, are you that guy from an event? No, I'm not. I swear you look like someone I know. I'd be like, I don't know what you're talking about. Beep, 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 get their groceries through and out. But there's no shame in that job. It was more sort of like the fact that I had to, on the one hand, you know, step on set and then people be serving your coffees in your one life, and you'd be coming home and you'd be treated like a superstar. And then you go to your job the next day and you know, just with a bunch of other people on the checkout serving people. But I think that's far more realistic to what life is about than what our acting job is about. It's a very strange world that we occupy. And it does make you appreciate a whole lot more what you have when you've got it. Mm. Don't mind, we will complain a lot on set, Tim, won't we?
Yeah.
What are you complaining about, guys?
There's everything to complain about, Suzanne, if you think hard about it.
There's that very classic actor's gag of the guy coming home to his girlfriend and saying, the most incredible things happen. I've just been cast. Oh my God, I'm the lead. Oh my God, it's with Robert De Niro. It's me and Robert De Niro. It's a two-hander. We're filming in Prague. It's for 6 months. It's going to be incredible. And do you know what the best part is? What? I've got tomorrow off. And I think that is very much the actor's sort of thing going, this is incredible, but I will have a Wed's lunch. That's a classic, classic actor.
I mean, it used to be an actor and see the world, but, you know, now I'm not sure that that is.
You'd think that, if anything, that might apply to me, but I thought that and was be an actor, see the world. Be an actor, see the inside of a hotel room is usually how it pans out. I remember one time that I'd heard a director once saying, I think it might have been Scorsese, who said that that casting is like 80 to 90% of a movie. And once you have that figured out, the direction is easy. And so when I hear that, I think, hang on, if a movie fails, is Scorsese saying that the casting director deserves 80 to 90% of the blame? I mean, can you think of any casting decisions that have really hurt a project that you've been involved with, or maybe to be safe, one that you haven't been involved with?
I don't know. I mean, sometimes I think, you know, sometimes I've watched things and thought, that was not the script that I read originally.
Yeah, I watched it and say, like, I wouldn't play it like that. You're going, like, I wouldn't have cast it like that.
Or I wouldn't direct it like that. But it's because I, Tim, as you know, I spend quite I spend quite a lot of time directing actors. So it's, but also you read the script. So sometimes you watch something and you think, what happened? Why did they cut this? Why did they cut that? And I'm not talking about Outlander. I'm talking about, you know, other productions. Because, you know, the lucky thing about Outlander is I go to the read-through, which is we have in blocks of two, we do two episodes. So we go and we read the scripts, and so you can hear the words that are nearly going to be in, and there's little tweaks before you actually shoot, but there's nothing that I've had a real disaster with I thought was wrong from my perspective. From other perspectives, sometimes I've gone, oh god, that is really so great, or I wish they had that scene that I really liked in. Why did they cut that? But
Hollywood is full of casting stories and decisions that, you know, almost were.
And sometimes, you know, actors say no, and you just go, I don't get why you said no, but you can't persuade somebody if they have no affinity with the script.
Exactly. I mean, there's always those famous articles that get thrown up in the media from time to time, like actors that famously turn down roles. Ones that stick in my mind are like Will Smith turned down The Matrix. I think Gwyneth Paltrow turned down Titanic. One that I saw recently was Al Pacino turned down Han Solo, which I think, you know, that decision is probably worked out for
that
the
was
best.
A good decision.
I'd love to see Al Pacino and Chewbacca, you know, flying through space in the Millennium Falcon, just both of them screaming their heads off.
Yeah. Four parsecs, hoo ha, straight to Wuhan. Fast, Chewie.
That's my Chewbacca. That was your Al Pacino for anyone who is confused. But there's sometimes, you know, there are actors that get so synonymous with a role. But there's sometimes when you think, what if Sean Connery had played Gandalf or whatever? Do you look back on casting decisions you make and wonder, what if?
Not really, because that's sort of always, that's the, I haven't sort of done that, because sort of at the time you might have gone, oh god, they should have chosen so and so and they didn't, you feel that an actor could have given more to a role. It doesn't have to be a lead role, it could be any role, but then you just have to get over it, you know. In the end, it's I was taught casting by a wonderful lady called Rose Tobias Shaw. I was her assistant associate for 5 years. She was brought up in the Bronx. She went through Ellis Island. She died in her 90s. She was an incredible woman. And I learned a lot from her. And one was the rule of three. She said, and it's proved right, she said, you can have your opinion or try and persuade people three times. Don't do it any more than three, because they won't listen.
Wow.
And
that's a good rule of life.
She's been, and I take the rule of three.
What are the ways that you try to persuade people to your opinion on a casting choice?
Sometimes people ask my opinion, sometimes they don't. So you get to know, you know, people's psychology.
Right.
When you're working, you're working with them. I do turn down projects that I have no affinity with, or I don't like the people involved.
You just like get a headshot and slowly push it under the nose of Ron or someone. What about this person?
And a little bit subtler than that, but
more so. Okay, I'm clearly not cut out to be a casting director.
Usually, like, just a mug with their picture on it, very subliminal. It's like, what?
Just holding it up to your face. Yeah,
this was a Christmas gift. Yeah, I don't know what you're talking.
Australian actor.
Have you ever thought of taking any trips to Australia, Ron? And by the way, I've got this Australian actor. I thought you might be interested.
Well, showreels are a good thing, because sometimes, you know, if producers or directors only see a person in one light, you can then, you know, show other sort of facets to their work and their depth as an actor.
I'm constantly looking for ways to improve my showreel, to get more depth and more. Look at my range. Look, I can play drug addict. I can play upper class guy. I can play. Actors love to do that. We want to see that we can be right for anything. And I think we want casting directors to think of it in that way.
Well, I hate that thing when people sort of say, so who do you see me as? And you go, right. No, I don't want to put you in a box, you know, sort of, what's my range? You know, where, you know, I mean, the only thing I would say is about, you know, age, you know, sort of, because you have on Spotlight here, you know, you're playing age. But sometimes, you know, sort of people in their 30s have 16 too, you know. 35 and you just go.
Yeah, I think that leads to this question of diversity in casting. And I don't know if you're aware of this, Tim, but while I personally think that, Tim, you are very handsome and talented, I'm afraid Hollywood likes to call guys like you and me pale, male, and stale. And I believe that's also what your wife calls you from time to time.
It is. It is. That's yeah, the thing.
I thought so. But anyway, I want to know, what's your view on diversity in casting, and where do you draw the line on this issue? Are you willing to look past things like nationality, race, sexuality, etc., if an actor is really right for the role?
Well, I mean, it's I think you know, American networks have always been aware that to have more diverse roles, and whether it's, you know, women as well, I would add to that. But most of the shows, a lot of the shows that I work on have been you know, quite diverse. I did something recently called Shadow and Bone, and we have the most diverse cast in that for Netflix. And I was doing another show for Netflix, which was going to start filming in Madrid, but a week before filming, of course, it was closed down. And we had, you know, actors from all over Europe, and also, you know, some diverse and diverse casting as well. I think, you know, and on other shows, you know, I have sort of said, well, can we change that to a woman? Because there's so many, you know, roles are sort of male-led. And I think that has changed, but should still keep changing. We're on Outlander, we have a female lead, which is fantastic. And now there's more and more shows with females in the lead. Mm-hmm. I think it's very important to reflect our society. You know, we live in... Tim and I live in London, so you just walk down the street and we have such a diverse, you know, London is very diverse. We did a show for YouTube called Origin, where it was a science fiction, and we cast worldwide. We had, you know, Japanese, German, Spanish, you know, English. So it was very, and French, all speaking their own language and English.
What if it comes down to you found the right person, but they're not the right race, they're not the right sex, they're not the right nationality? What are we doing there? I mean, there's been some famous blunders in Hollywood, like I think Emma Stone is one of them that we pointed out I think is the Descendants. She was playing Hawaiian or something like that. There's one that in Australia that got a lot of flack. It was called Gods of Egypt, and they had a whole lot of white people running around being Egyptians. But surely there's circumstances where you have the right actor, but they're not right nationality or whatever. Or you have the wrong actor, or how important is authenticity? I mean, I don't want to lead you here, but you had like Cherokee people that you had to cast in Outlander. And then you've also had to cast some Scottish people who aren't Scottish. You've had to cast an English person who is an Australian. You found the right person, but for whatever reason, they're not the right thing. Where do you draw the lines?
Well, our native Indians are all native. They're not. That is, you know, on Outlander, it's very important. It's very important to us. If you are French, you speak French, and you are French. So we've cast French actors. The same as we've cast some, you know, German actors. But equally, you know, we've had Lottie Verbeek as Dutch, who's playing Scottish.
Right.
But all our native Indians have native passports, heritage. That is very, very important to Outlander.
So why is that important, and then not maybe Lotta's heritage, for example?
I mean, she was the right actress for the role. She, you know, sort of she had the right vibe for it. Heritage is she was the right actress for the role. But would you have sort of people made up as American Native Indians who are not? No, you would not.
Well, if you're asking 1950s, David, I probably would say yes. It's we've had a huge evolution in how we cast things.
I think it's more global now. You know, sort of at one time it wasn't. And everybody, you know, all the Brits and Australians used to go to America. Now, you know, so many productions are done outside of America.
Yeah. I have a fun fantasy kind of football question for all of us for the end. It's a hypothetical, so please don't take it too seriously. But let's just say Outlander is not yet a thing. We're all going to be casting directors here, okay? Mm-hmm. For whatever reason, every actor that's currently on the show is not available. Like, they've given up acting and gone to real estate, or they're in rehab or abducted by aliens. I don't know. But you can have any actor alive or dead. Who are you casting in Outlander? So I'm going to give you mine, all right? I'm thinking Liam Neeson for Jamie Fraser, playing it safe. Meryl Streep as Claire Fraser. And I think she's going to double bill here. She's going to double bill for Brianna because she's just that good. Then I'm going to go for Sean Connery as Roger. Then, of course, for Tim in Tryon's role, I'm thinking someone who's got that beautiful sense of entitled upper crust smug that you play to perfection. So I'm thinking maybe Tom Hiddleston.
Interesting.
Yes. Ooh, and right. Then finally, if I were to cast myself, I'm going to go with Tom Cruise. It was a toss-up between him and Dwayne The Rock Johnson. I just thought maybe those muscles would have a hard time fitting into my clothes. But I want to throw the question back to you. It's the fantasy football of Outlander. Who are we casting? Firstly, Tim.
If we were going to go purely on height and not age, then I would, you mentioned him earlier, I'd love John Lithgow as a Jamie Fraser. I think he'd be fantastic.
Wow.
I think bring a certain sort of, he'd bring certain something. I mean, the man can be in Bigfoot and the Hendersons and play Churchill. So the range is definitely there. For Claire, I would love to see someone like Jodie Foster. I'm a massive fan of Jodie Foster. Really, I definitely think Summersby sort of era, where I think she'd be fabulous. I was having a think, actually, David, as you were mentioning yourself, and I would think what would be amazing, who would be amazing to play you, is maybe a Martin Short. I think he would be absolutely perfect. I could really
would. You know what? If he called me up tomorrow and said, David, I want your role, I would say, absolutely, Martin, it's yours. Just get Steve Martin to play Tryon's role, and then we'll have our own spin-off. How about that? Boom.
Perfect.
Right. It writes itself.
But I go and have a look at Three Amigos and tell me if I'm wrong, David. Tell me if I'm wrong. Suzanne, so right. What do you think?
Well, first of all, for Tryon's role, I thought it should be David Niven.
Yes. Ooh. Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
That's a great choice.
Of course. Wonderful.
And for Jamie, I thought, well, one of the Hemsworths, really, sort of the Australians.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many choices there. Yeah. There's about five or six of them, aren't there? I get mistaken for one of them from time to time.
Do you?
I'm Australian. I don't know. Maybe I'm just flattering myself. Yeah. Okay, who we got as Claire?
Oh, gosh, that's really so difficult. because she's so sort of I was going to go with Meryl when you and then you and you said it and I thought no.
Hey, Meryl is never a bad choice.
No.
Never a bad choice.
I mean, I will second you on that.
We got Roger, Brianna, and then finally Lord John, please.
I hadn't really thought of Roger and Brianna.
No, I hadn't. Maybe Brianna, Emma Stone. You mentioned Emma Stone. I think she'd be brilliant. She'd be very good. Okay. Or Rachel McAdams, maybe.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm down with it.
There you go.
Suzanne?
Oh, gosh. I don't, it's so difficult when I've cast them to put it in a sort of a, in a funny way or whatever. I'm gonna sort of not say I think
that's fine. Meryl Streep for everything. She can play
Meryl
Batman
Streep the whole way. And maybe for Roger, just have a left field thought. Kevin Hart,
diverse.
Just sort of throw that in there. I would worry be a bit short. But that would. I think he'd be fabulous.
Hey, I'm with you. Kevin Hart is a great actor. I'm just not sure about his Scottish accent, but I'm sure he can work on it. That man can do anything.
That may be his downfall, is his Inverness accent may prove a stumbling block. I don't know how he is on regional Scottish accents. Maybe he's amazing.
Well, we do have a very good dialect coach, so...
Easy. See? Easy.
Mm-hmm. It's true.
Wonderful. Well, look, Suzanne, thank you so much for your time today. It's been a real insight and wonderful, wonderful to chat to you.
Yeah, same guys. You take care.
And you as well.
Thank you.
Bye.
Okay, Tim, it's time for our listener mail. We have a great one here. I think you're going to like this one, Tim.
Oh, yeah.
It's from a very special person. Someone very famous has been listening to our podcast.
No, they haven't.
Oh, apparently they have. It says, I, Bill Gates. There you go. Bill Gates, Tim, is our listener. Okay.
Yeah.
Bill Gates and my wife have decided to donate the sum of $10,500,000 to you as part of our charity to improve the 10 lucky individuals all over the world. Okay, play goes on and on and on. Let's see how we get this. To facilitate the payment process of $10,500,000, which have been donated solely to you, you are to send me your full names, your contact address, your personal telephone number. He says here, thank you very much from Mr. Bill Gates and Melinda Gates. Remain blessed.
Wow.
I think we should do a 50-50 split on that. Tim, how are you going to spend your
50-50? I think so. Wow. I mean, that's quite a shock. I didn't really think I'd be earning $5 million that easily. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. and Mrs. Gates. I think, first of all, I mean, if we weren't in the situation we are, I'd say I'll go on holiday, but can't do that. I don't know. Buy pictures, maybe. Maybe some paint. The house. Maybe I'll do something like that. Start small, and then might get a dog. Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe that. How about you?
Oh, I don't know. I've got a great idea. We could make our own movie, Tim. We could make our own movie with that amount of money. We could make our own series. We could make the Lord John and Governor Tryon show. That's something. I have a script, ready to go. That's where I'm going to spend my money. Actually,
that is an incredible idea. Let's do that. Now, in a way, we're giving back.
We are.
In a funny way, much like Mr. and Mrs. Gates. Thank you again for your kind donation.
So, Tim, I'm just going to need your full name and your contact address and your telephone number. We'll put that in and then we'll get the money, all right?
That sounds great. I'll also provide you with my mother's maiden name and my first school. I don't see any problem with that.
Great.
Thank you for listening to Outcasts.
Please remember to rate, subscribe, and leave a review, as it all helps.
Follow us on our Instagram page at outcast.podcast for all the latest updates.
Or you can send us an email at outcastspodcastshow@gmail.com.
Every week, we shall select a question from one of our listeners to answer on the show.
The theme music is composed by Kieran Ledwidge. All views and opinions expressed on the show are our own and have no affiliation with the series of books written by Diana Gabaldon or the Sony Stars television show Outlander.
No animals were harmed in the making of this podcast. Although I did have a ham sandwich earlier, so...
See you next time.
See you next time.
Tired Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.